So it seemed like it was time to just balance out some of what we've been focusing here on Thursday evening with a little bit of joy. There's certainly lots of room in our lives, and our brains tend to hyperfocus on the things that aren't going well, or things that are difficult. And so part of spiritual practice, and certainly part of Buddhist practice, is bringing the mind more to balance. So paying attention to joy is really important. Being mindful of joy. So that's what I want to focus on this evening. And I'd like to start with a short reading from the Dhammapada, which are the kind of the most accessible teachings of the Buddha. And this section is called Joy. Live in joy and love, even among those who hate. Live in joy and health, even among the afflicted. Live in joy and peace, even among the troubled. Look within, be still. Free from fear and attachment, know the sweet joy of the way. One of the things that I've been noticing that's joyful in my experience is the absence of clinging, the absence of craving. Sometimes when the mind lets go, it's really joyful. Or the absence of fear. There was a big experience of that many years ago. I was sharing with someone earlier today about something I haven't talked about for a long time, and I won't go into all of the details this evening, but I was up climbing Mount Hood, and I was with a group of novices. There was one group, or one member of our group, who was more experienced. And we all placed our trust in him, and it turned out that he really didn't know what he was doing. And so we climbed up this ice face in August. And it wasn't a good time to do it, because of course when the sun comes up, we went up at midnight. It was fine when it was cool in the morning, but then when it started to get sunny, it, of course, started to melt, and we'd climbed up this ice face, and we couldn't get up any further to the top of the mountain, because it was beyond our capability. So the only alternative was to go back down, and our leader said, "Oops, I think I've climbed us beyond my capacity. I'm not sure how to get us back down." So we did have some equipment, and we did have some ropes, so I was the first person to go down, and there was a little ice ledge about halfway down this ice face. It was about this wide, and so they lowered me down on a rope, and I had to stand there, because there wasn't anything else to do, and down about 100 feet below me was a crevasse, a bergstrom, that I was sure I was going to fall into. And it was terrifying. Don't think I've ever been so frightened, so scared. And eventually, I guess obviously, since I'm sitting here talking to you, we did find a way down. And the reason I'm sharing it with you this evening is because the experience of euphoria, the experience of joy, I felt like I was born again. I'd faced death, and somehow managed to survive. So there's that kind of joy that comes sometimes. What I've discovered over the years with Dharma practice is that it's more and more subtle things. That was a pretty big thing, but more and more subtle things lead to joy. The experience of relinquishment, of letting go of clinging, is a joyful experience. There's a poem that speaks to relinquishment that is one that I love, and those who've come here on Thursdays regularly have heard this one before, but it's one that I never get tired of listening to or reading. And it's from William Blake. It's called Eternity. She who binds herself to a joy does the winged life destroy, but she who kisses the joy as it flies lives in eternity's sunrise. So there's this emphasis on the fleeting nature of things and the joy that comes from relinquishment, from letting go, letting things be. One of the foundations of the Buddhist teaching is that what we think has a lot to do with what we experience, how we see the world, that our thinking colors our perceptions and has a lot to do with how we feel, how we emotionally experience things. And in the Dhammapada, the Buddha said, we are what we think, all that arises with our thoughts. With our thoughts, we make the world. And I said earlier that our brains tend to be tilted in a negative direction. And so part of this emphasis on this practice of mudita is to help expand our perceptions so that we can experience the joy that comes our way, that is around us all the time, and not miss that experience of life. The definition of mudita is it's described as the Buddhist teaching on the mind deliverance of gladness. So there's something about being freed, being delivered into the experience of gladness. And so it's an invitation to look at what brings joy to us in our own experience. But it also expands out to look at the causes of joy for others, so that it's not caught up in a self-preoccupation, but it's really about the universal experience of joy and how we can observe that in other people as it arises. And just to kind of situate it within the Buddha's teaching, the Buddha was talking about four wholesome mental emotional states that are part of our human inheritance that we can cultivate, that we can expand, build on. And so in addition to the sympathetic joy or mudita practice or consciousness, really, is loving kindness, which is that just full-hearted feeling of love and acceptance. There's compassion. And then equanimity, which is the sort of unflappable, balanced state of mind that is able to meet whatever arises with just clear seeing, its clarity. So I'm not going to talk about the other three this evening, but I just want to mention that that's where it's situated. And it also comes up in the Buddhist teaching in the Eightfold Path in something called right intention, which is about how we can shape our minds by through conscious intention, using intention is a way of cultivating our hearts and minds in wholesome directions. One of the reasons I like talking about mudita is that it is contrary to what most people who don't have much experience with Buddhism, who might have a kind of cursory understanding, think about what the Buddha taught. Because the first thing, if you read something on Buddhism, the first thing you read is suffering. There's suffering. There's suffering, the cause of suffering, the end of suffering, and the path that leads. That's the Eightfold Path, the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. But it is actually all about joy and freedom, because when we experience freedom from clinging, joy is what happens, joy and peace. So it actually is a teaching about joy. And we can experience it in many different ways. And one of the things that the Buddha discovered, maybe it wasn't totally his discovery, but he certainly really emphasized it and talked about it with great clarity, is that our minds can be cultivated. That whatever state of conditioned tendencies and habits of mind, patterns of thinking that we experience, those are all amenable to our conscious cultivation. So, and there's a word in Sanskrit which is bhavana that is used to refer to meditation, but its root is to cultivate. So in Sanskrit, it could mean cultivation, like a farmer cultivates a field. And I love that kind of organic metaphor for what we're doing with our practice, because it's creating the conditions for joy to grow, creating the conditions for wholesome states of mind that lead us away from suffering. And it's like it is... using the fertilizer of unwholesome states through being mindful of them, turning them into the rich, fertile soil to plant the seeds of joy in. And it's also nice, that metaphor, because it isn't coerced or forced. It's, it's creating the conditions. I think that's probably the best way. Recently, I heard a description of awakening from a Zen teacher who said that when the experience of awakening or dibbana happens, it's accidental. But we have to practice in order to be accident prone. So that's what we're doing with practice. We can't make it happen, but we can create the conditions for it. It's like opening the windows. We can't make the breeze blow, but sometimes the breeze does blow, and if the window isn't open, we're not going to experience it. So for reasons of survival, our human brain tends to emphasize negative experiences. Survival value coming from our evolution in the jungle as a species. The greatest threats to survival, the tiger that might be off in the brush, or whatever it is that was the predator that might have been stalking us, Those human beings with really developed fight, flight, freeze, faint response patterns were the ones who survived and passed on their genetic material. So our nervous system, our emotional brain, is pretty much set up that way. Even though we've had human civilization for, 10,000 years or maybe longer, that really, in terms of the evolution of the human brain, is just a blink of an eye. It's not very long. So human beings have been around for a million years or so, approximately. So we're just at the beginning of kind of stepping out of that programming and conditioning that's really deep in us. So we're but we can consciously work with that. Most of us aren't stalked by tigers these days. I mean, not to say that there aren't real dangers in our lives, but a lot of times our brains are reacting in ways that are set up to have us survive those kinds of experiences that were a threat to our very survival, when that's not really what's happening. And while our brain is doing that, kind of working overtime, the thing that isn't happening is noticing all the wonderful things that are going on. We kind of miss them. We get caught up in the residue, the fallout of our emotional experiencing, to the degree that there's anxiety, anger, just kind of stress happening. There's residual adrenaline and cortisol pumping through our bloodstream. We can easily get caught up and miss those moments of beautiful sunsets and wonderful flowers and the twinkle in a baby's eyes, and those moments that are really wonderful and beautiful. So with mindfulness, there's the possibility of returning to the present moment, to really show up and be present for those life experiences. And the more that we do that, the more opportunity there is to experience joy. So with practice, bringing more full attention, full embodied attention to the cornucopia of life that is around us. It's particularly evident for me this time of year. I like to garden, and noticing, I mean, there's some things that didn't do well this year, but I was sharing earlier with Paul the bumper crop of blueberries this year. It's this wonderful thing, going out in the morning, picking fresh blueberries for breakfast. It's just so joyful. It's wonderful. And it's just a simple thing, but it just gives me, it's a wonderful way to start with some joy in the morning. So by just being present for those things, we start to condition our brains to be able to be more present. So it creates a kind of positive momentum. For those who might be concerned that I'm putting on rose-colored glasses and becoming kind of Pollyannish in my perspective here, mindfulness doesn't have an agenda. It doesn't have a dog in the fight, so to speak. It's just present, non-judgmentally, with what is. So it's here with the truth. It's not coloring it one way or the other. So if I miss the rock on the way down from the garden and I stub my toe, there's mindfulness present with pain and discomfort and whatever the agony is in the mind. So it's not ignoring that. Although you might say, well, you know, you wouldn't have stubbed your toe in the first place if you weren't lost in the sort of blissful experience of blueberries. But, you know, there's learning from that experience too. So, it's more just a kind of coming to balance. Instead of getting lost in the story of, you know, it's kind of difficult in life. Maybe I can sort of, struggle my way through this day, and with that attitude, missing those moments. So. And there's something about Rick Hansen, who I know is a friend of mine, who has written several books on the neuroscience of happiness related to and coming from a Buddhist perspective, said it takes, based on a neuroscience sort of look at the brain, it takes about a $100 positive experience to equal a $1 negative experience in terms of the way our brains work. Because of that survival conditioning that's in there. And so part of what we're doing is trying to kind of even the playing field a little bit. And, you know, one of the things he says, you know, at the end of the day, what does the brain usually do? Well, it often reflects on all the things that went wrong, the things that we needed to correct, the things we didn't like that we said. You know, I used to experience it as cringing. I said that. That was stupid. I mean, the judging mind comes up. But there could be an opportunity to reflect with a little bit more balance, particularly if we were paying more attention, and with some compassion, and with the possibility of joy. So, and so it's good for us paying attention to positive stuff. Lowers our stress response, increases our resilience, probably helps ward off depression and anxiety to some extent. In fact, with folks, I work as a therapist and a counselor with people who are experiencing mild to moderate depression. I often recommend that they start with, after I teach a little bit of mindfulness, just noticing pleasantness. Not that it's going to completely eliminate depression, but it might take a little bit of the edge off if we can notice the cracks around it. Because it often comes laced with this belief that's pretty convincing that it's always been gray or dark, and it always will be. And if we can directly experience that that's not really true, then it makes it a little more manageable. Even if, you know, things are pretty difficult most of the day, if I could spend 5 minutes just experiencing some pleasure, maybe it's just the sunshine on my shoulders as I'm sitting outside eating lunch and just bringing awareness to that, it starts to kind of shake my belief in that monolithic experience of depression. So don't take it quite so seriously. So it's a resource. The other thing I want to mention, I've been talking with a lot of people recently about the importance in relationship of noticing positive things in our friends, partners, spouses. John and Julie Gottman, who are relationship researchers and therapists, have been doing research for 30 years, and they suggest a 5-to-1 ratio, 5 positives to every negative in the relationship. Because, again, because of that survival conditioning, instinctual conditioning, we really need to emphasize the positive, build up a positive emotional bank account by recognizing the things that we might take for granted that our friends, partners, spouses do. And I've talked with many people about that who've put that into practice, and it's really transformed their relationships. Relationships tend to be, over time, kind of the dumping ground for our gripes and complaints, if we're not careful. And then the relationship can kind of be defined by the negatives. And that's not really that useful. In fact, I remember working with one couple many years ago. They were very creative, and they'd gotten into one of those negative slumps where they were just noticing all of the negative stuff that the other person was doing. And so they decided, I can't take any therapeutic credit for this. They totally generated it themselves. They decided to identify two of their friends that they both respected and loved very much. They had pictures that they blew up and made into masks. And then they each wore one of the masks of their friends. And for a weekend, they related to the other person as if it were the mask. And it transformed their relationship, really changed the nature of it. So they were noticing positive instead of negative. And, you know, if you're with a partner, you know, taking them for granted, this person that you're spending your life with, or a dear friend, is really a tragedy. So there's an opportunity to practice mudita, to practice joy. So. So there's noticing our own experience of joy. There's noticing it in those, our loved ones. The Buddha takes joy to a whole other level, really. Because the practice of mudita isn't just about us as individuals. It's taking delight in the happiness of others, even people we don't really know. That's the kind of ultimate expression of it. And it's really cool because if you think about the implication of that, if you're into math or even if you aren't, it exponentially increases our potential for joy. If I can take delight in the happiness of others and I don't get caught up in, so what am I getting here? That expands the field of joy tremendously. And that's where this practice leads, because all practices in Buddhism ultimately lead in the direction of there aren't any others. There's just us. We're all part of the fabric of life, where we are all connected. And in some way, truly, your happiness is mine. You know, we affect each other, even if we're not aware of it. So, so there's that understanding. So this practice overcomes the false view that separates them from us in any context. And just to mention a few of the afflictions or causes of suffering that this practice helps with, and then I'm going to talk specifically about what the practice is, more specifically. One of the things that comes up is judgment. We all have ideas about how other people should be, and opinions about the way we want others to be. And so this is about cultivating the flexibility of mind and letting go of attachment so that we can uphold another's happiness as a priority over our own righteousness. Instead of being attached to being right, I can be here with, wow, this person is really enjoying this aspect of their life. Isn't that wonderful? You know, for most people, joy is such a fleeting thing. Isn't it great that they can experience this? May their happiness continue and increase. One of the things that is part of the practice of the cultivation of the what are called the Brahma Viharas, the four divine abodes, loving kindness, compassion, equanimity and sympathetic joy, is using using intentional thought as a way to help cultivate the mind in that direction. So one of the phrases that's used is, may your happiness continue and increase. Instead of getting caught up in, I wish I had some of that, or you don't deserve that. Getting caught up in the comparing mind. It's very powerful. In Buddhism, it's called conceit. We get pulled outside of ourselves, comparing ourselves with others, measuring ourselves, and it's just a recipe for suffering, for mental anguish. And probably we all know on some level that if we compare ourselves with others, we're always going to find people who are doing it better than we are in some way, shape, or form. So it's really, it's not helpful. And there's a kind of subtle or not so subtle competition that can happen in relationships. So, and one of the things I say when I work with couples is, you know, if you're competing with each other, if there's winners and losers, you both lose. Because your happiness is not separate. So if someone feels like a loser and they're unhappy, that's going to affect your happiness. And that's not just true in, individual or in intimate relationships. In fact, the Buddha said, in battle, the winners and losers both lose. And then from the Sufi tradition, Rumi said, in one of his wonderful poems, in the wondrous world that is, we never really own anything. So why the strange competition then, as we go one at a time through the same gate? So I'd like to do a little bit of practice with this now, and I think the best way to understand it on a little deeper level is to do direct practice of mudita. And so the first part of that I'm just going to invite as a meditation. So if you'd like to just let your eyes close, just stay comfortable, relax. And I'm just going to guide you through this for a few minutes. So just bringing awareness back into the breath in just a really relaxed, comfortable way. Just noticing a few breaths, maybe consecutively. And this practice is about directing the mind in a particular way. And traditionally we start with someone who's easy to practice mudita with. And a lot of times it isn't ourselves, although for some it might be easier. But I'll start the traditional way and just invite you to think of someone that you know who's easy to wish well. Someone you have maybe a lot of love for, who you know is experiencing or has been experiencing some joy or delight in their life. And just letting this person come to mind. It could be just a real simple interaction that you remember. And as you bring this person into mind, maybe you visualize them or hear the sound of their voice or have a felt sense, to just in your heart, if you experience them as joyful, to perhaps say the words, may this happiness continue and increase. Or you could try, may the sources of your happiness be protected. You could experiment. But the idea with this practice is to use a phrase and repeat it over a few times. You can actually keep going with it as long as you want. We don't, unfortunately, this evening have unlimited time, so I'm going to create some artificial time constraints. But just to repeat it a few times and notice what happens. And if the mind wanders, of course, be gentle with yourself. Notice where it goes and just invite it to come back to your intended focus here. Repeat the phrases again. May your happiness continue and increase. May the sources of your happiness be protected. So I'm going to invite us to transition now and shift over to the next step in the practice. And this might be a little more difficult for some of us, so please, again, be gentle with yourself, and if it's easier to stay with another person rather than yourself, then by all means do that. You could kind of work up to it. But the invitation now is to reflect on things that bring us joy. Maybe something recently where there was joy present, or happiness. Could be often it's easiest to start with simple things, like some of the things I was describing. And to let the experience of that come to mind. And then if you'd like to try the mudita phrase or phrases, you could try them on, changing the wording a little bit. May my happiness continue and increase. May the sources of my happiness be protected. So noticing what joy feels like. If the feeling does come up, it may not. I mean, maybe it's too kind of distant in this moment, but we can still practice with intention. It's a wonderful thing about these practices, is that it's about intention. And just again as a reminder, may my happiness continue and increase. May the sources of my happiness be protected. So I want to emphasize that this is a really brief kind of intro to the practice this evening. But you, if this works for you, if you find it beneficial, you can extend it and do it for whole categories of people that you might find yourself feeling competitive with or jealous of or have judgments towards. It's a way of counteracting that. So there's another story that I'd like to share with you. It's pretty brief. I've shared it before, but I just really like this story because it warms my heart to remember. It brings me joy to think about it. So back quite a number of years ago, my nephew, David, graduated from high school, and I was invited to go to his graduation. And he went to a rather large high school, a large graduating class. And it'd been a while since I'd been to a high school graduation. And he was towards the end of the alphabet. They went alphabetically. And there was all of these young people walking across the stage. And I noticed the mind getting bored, going into dullness, and, oh, geez, how long am I going to have to sit here? How many people are up there? And I was just learning about these practices back then, and then I remembered, oh, there's mudita practice. And, you know,